People have often asked me over the years, how did you become an activist? And what made you decide to become an activist? What was that pivotal event in your life? And for years and years, I thought about it. I tried to now, when did I really become an activist? You know, what happened that made me commit my life to doing this work? And I came up with some ideas. You know, so at one point I said, well, it must have been when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama was bombed. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, and knew Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and the two other girls who were killed during that church. As a matter of fact, my mother took the mother of Carol to the church to pick her up after they discovered that the church had been bombed. And that did have a profound effect on me. These were, you know, girls in my neighborhood, friends of my sister's, girls my mother had taught in school that I knew. So for a while I decided that, you know, that was what had set me on that path. But then I thought, I said, well, actually, I was active before 1963. So, you know, it couldn't have been then. So I came up with various explanations, events, pivotal events in my life. And finally, after struggling with this for years, I decided that there really was no particular moment when I decided to become an activist. As a matter of fact, I grew up with the idea that in order to live in segregated circumstances, Birmingham was the most segregated city in the South when I grew up there, that my parents basically taught us that we had to be critical of the way things were. You know, otherwise, we could not affirm our own humanity. And that we had to dedicate our lives to the kind of transformation that would make this a better world to live in, you know, for all of us. And so I guess I've learned that wherever I am, whatever I happen to be doing at the moment, I have to fulfill that commitment that has informed my life. So I want to begin by suggesting that whoever you are, you know, wherever you are, you know, whether you are a student, an academic, whether you are a worker, whether you are a person involved in your church, whether you are an artist, there are always ways to gear your work towards progressive, radical transformation. And I'm going to try to argue for the need to bring about some radical structural changes in this society. One of the things that I've been thinking about a great deal lately is the prison system. Actually, I've been thinking about the prison system for a long, long time. I ended up in jail because of the work that I was doing around the prison system in California back in the late 60s, when we were very angry that such vast numbers of people like George Jackson, who was a brilliant thinker, strategist, who at age 18 had been convicted of stealing or being involved with some guys who stole $70 from a gas station. At age 18, he was sentenced to from 1 year to life by the California Youth Authority, which meant that he could have gotten out after 1 year, but at the same time, by the same token, he could have spent the rest of his life in prison. As it turns out, he did spend the rest of his relatively short life in prison. He was killed some 12 years after he was incarcerated. Many of us, we were doing work around the case of the Soledad brothers and other political prisoners from the Black Panther Party, other political organizations, began to realize, especially as a result of the work that we were doing with George Jackson, that the prison system as a whole served as a weapon of political repression, racist repression, affecting not only those who were incarcerated for explicitly political reasons, but the majority of the people who were there, who virtually all of whom were poor. I mean, how many rich people are there in prison? A few here and there. And there still are those sort of country club prisons reserved for them. But the vast majority of people are poor people. And a disproportionate number of those poor people were and continue to be people of color, people of African descent, Latinos, Native Americans. Now, some of you may know that the most likely people to go to prison in this country today are young African American men, right? A few years ago, there was a report that was done by the Sentencing Project indicating that about 25% of all young men between the ages of, 18 and 24 or so were incarcerated. 25%. That was, I think, in 1991. A few years later, the Sentencing Project did a similar report and discovered that within 3 or 4 years, the percentage had soared to over 32%. And by now, that percentage has probably gone up. So we're talking about over one-third of all young black men in this country in prison or directly under the surveillance and control of the criminal justice system. Now, something is wrong with that, don't you think? I mean, one of the problems, of course, is that as we see the material expansion of the criminal justice system, what I call the prison industrial complex, there is also an ideological campaign to persuade people that criminals can be recognized by virtue of their race. That, as a matter of fact, the figure of the criminal is indeed a young black man. And so all of us learn how to be afraid of young black men. Am I right? And this happens often regardless of what race or ethnicity we might be, because the same thing happens in black communities. The black people learn how to be afraid of young black men. Now, this isn't to say that there aren't young black men out there committing acts that are horrible and violent acts at that. But what I want to suggest is that there is a reason why increasing numbers of people of color, and women as well, because ever larger numbers of women are going to prison. Some of you may know about the women's prison at Canyon City here in Colorado. But there is a reason why ever larger numbers of people are being corralled in these dungeons that are increasingly devoted to developing ever more effective technologies of punishment. Because it used to be, when you talked about prison, people associated that with rehabilitation, right? The reason to go to prison is to, you know, learn how to be a better citizen. But now, no one talks about that anymore. It's about punishment, pure punishment. It's about these supermax prisons that prevent those who are incarcerated there from having any kind of human contact. You know, where people live in cells 8 by 16 feet with no fresh air, no window, a steel gate with no human contact. As a matter of fact, at the federal prison in Florence, which is a supermax prison, the prisoners even have electronic escorts when they move from place to place. Actually, they are required to be in their cells for 23 hours a day, and 1 hour a day, sometimes, they're outside. So, you know, there's a reason why we're witnessing these developments. And what frightens me is that people are simply letting it happen. And many of us participate in the processes that allow for the construction of ever more prisons. We vote in favor of the prison bonds. We vote for three strikes and you're out laws. And we don't ask ourselves why, you know, suddenly in the last, say, 15 years or so, you know, why this incredible increase in the need for prisons? Why this focus on crime? Well, we're surrounded by crime. You know, most of us are extremely afraid of crime, right? Am I right? I mean, we're surrounded by it. And I'm not going to suggest that there isn't real crime that is being created. There's a lot of real crime, and not only the people who are represented as criminals are the ones responsible for that crime. I mean, we can talk about corporate crime as well. You know, we can talk about crimes against the environment that will affect generations to come. But of course, these people generally only pay fines if they do that, right? They're not considered criminal. But in terms of the kind of crime that is usually referred to when the specter of crime is evoked, there hasn't been a great deal of increase in that. Perhaps among young people, that's the one area where there's been a significant rise in that kind of behavior, violent behavior. But in general, what we've seen is a rise in the representations of crime and violence on television, in the movies. We're surrounded by it. And we have been taught how to fear crime in a way that doesn't really speak to the objective threat of crime, but speaks to other fears, I think. It speaks to fears that we all have but have no way to express. And when we're told that what we're really afraid of is crime, then we have something to attach those fears to. I was a member of the Communist Party. I'm not a member of the Communist Party anymore, but I still consider myself very much a socialist. So we'll get to that later. But when I was fired from my position in the philosophy department, the very first teaching job I had in 1969 at UCLA. And before I had a chance to teach my first class, Ronald Reagan, who was the governor at that time, sort of instigated the Board of Regents to relieve me of my position because of my membership in the Communist Party. Well, during that period, I was the target of the most incredible kinds of attacks, verbal attacks. I got thousands and thousands of hate letters from people who told me to go back to Russia. And I had never been to Russia at that time, so, you know, go back to Russia. They also told me to go back to Africa, and I hadn't yet gone to Africa as well. It's interesting how they kind of merge my blackness and my communistness. But it occurred to me at that time that so many people had learned how to identify communism as their enemy, and oftentimes as their intimate enemy. That whenever someone was pointed out as being a communist, that person, myself included, became a magnet for all kinds of amazing violence and I won't even mention the epithets that I was called in these letters. But I realized then that something was really wrong. If people could fear communism in that kind of visceral way, when there weren't very many communists in the States at that time. The McCarthy era had basically, gotten rid of the organized communist movement because it was deemed illegal and people were arrested and taken to prison. But one of the reasons why the war in Vietnam was able to happen as long as it did was because of this fear of communism. And people pointed to the Vietnamese as their enemy, as if somehow or another, if the country defeated the communist enemy in Vietnam, things were going to be okay at home. People's lives would be better. They would feel better about themselves. And now, of course, with the socialist world in collapse, with the exception maybe of Cuba, what has happened is that other figures have moved into the vacuum that was created as far as the enemy was concerned with the fall of communism. So now the criminal becomes the enemy. The criminal that's figured largely as a young black man or a young Latino man, and increasingly as young women of color. But then there's some other figures as well that have moved into that vacuum. And if we look at the extent to which women on welfare have been demonized and represented as those who are basically stealing, pillaging the money that taxpayers earn. I mean, now the welfare system has been basically abolished. It's been basically disestablished. And of course, before the disestablishment of that system, welfare was less than 1% of the budget. And when you consider how much of the national political debate focused on welfare, that must tell us something about the way enemies are created, right? And now, of course, that the welfare system has been disestablished, and there are no jobs, so to speak, for the women who are told that if they don't work, that's just too bad. They can only get, welfare for a certain period of time, and then they have to find a job. Now, they haven't had the opportunity to go to an institution like this. They may not have skills. Where are they going to find a job? And if they have children, how are they going to pay for childcare in order to guarantee the conditions which will allow them to work? So what's going to happen with so many of these women? Many of them are going to have to look for alternative modes of survival since they can no longer depend on welfare. And they're going to be lured into the drug economy, The economy and sexual services, which are two of the sort of major alternative economies available to people who are not allowed to participate in the mainstream economy. And that's going to send them straight into the prison industrial complex. So if things do not change, we will be seeing ever larger numbers of women going into the prison system. And there's another enemy. And that enemy is the immigrant. It's not accidental, I don't think, that as this rhetoric, this anti-crime rhetoric developed, as the anti-welfare rhetoric developed, an anti-immigrant rhetoric also developed. You know, keep the borders closed, prevent the, and you see, it's interesting, it's not just a question of preventing people from other countries from coming to the U.S. and trying to establish a life here. It's a question of presenting certain kinds of people, people from certain countries, people from third world countries, people from Central America, people from Asia. I read a study that indicated that actually the largest number of illegal, quote, illegal immigrants come from European countries. But no one ever considers the possibility that a white person could be an illegal. I mean, I know quite a number of illegal people, you know, from places like Britain and France, who come in on student visas and decide to stay. And they don't even feel threatened. I mean, it's interesting. They are not even afraid of the INS. Whereas people who are, quote, legal citizens, but who look as if they might come from another country, fear what the INS might do to them. Or that if they don't have their ID with them, that they might get deported. So isn't it interesting that in all three of these examples that I've given, the figures are clearly racialized figures. And I think that there's a structural connection between the demonization of the immigrant and the criminalization of populations of color in this country. And let me give you just a sense of how I would try to make those connections. I said I might say a few words about capitalism, or did I? Well, I alluded to the fact that even though I'm no longer a member of the Communist Party, I'm still very much committed to democratic socialism and to finding ways to challenge a capitalist system which has probably an even vaster impact on our lives, on our daily lives, than ever before. Because we're talking about capitalism in the age of globalization, right? We're talking about global capitalism. We're talking about transnational capitalism. What we are witnessing is the development of a circuit of corporations that belong to no particular nation state. That are not expected to respect the laws of any given nation state, that move across borders at will in search, in perpetual search of what? More profits. As a matter of fact, speaking of transnational corporations, I can remember a long time ago when Nike was just sort of getting started. And I was really sort of impressed by this, little company up in Oregon that was producing these shoes. I was just beginning to run in those days. And my first pair of running shoes were Nikes. And I got attached to Nikes. I sort of convinced myself that I can't run without my Nikes. Nike Air, Nike Air Max, Air Max Square. But I think I've bought my last pair of Nike running shoes. And it's actually, quite interesting that people like Michael Jordan and, of course, Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods, what, has a $40 million contract with Nike? Isn't that right? Something like that. But at the same time, Nike is in Indonesia creating working conditions that are worse in many respects than slavery. And in Vietnam, as a matter of fact, Nike has a factory in Ho Chi Minh City. Not long ago, there was an investigation of that particular factory, and it was discovered that the women, and we're talking about women as well, who manufacture these shoes, that the women working in the Ho Chi Minh City factory were not only paid less than the minimum wage there, which is a couple of dollars a day, $2.50 a day. How much do you pay for your Nikes? One of the women workers there described an incident during which some of the women came into work wearing the wrong shoes. Apparently they're supposed to wear indoor shoes and outdoor shoes, interesting shoes. They came in wearing the wrong shoes. They were severely punished. They were forced to run. How ironic. They were forced to run for several hours, around in a circle, around the factory, until a number of the women collapsed. Some of the women had to be taken to the emergency, had to be taken to the hospital, and that's just one incident. I mean, if you've read the entire report, you would be amazed that people are treated this way in this age. So what does Nike do? They go down and ask Andrew Young, another black man, to be their spokesperson in connection with this investigation. I think we need to talk about an organized boycott of Nike. I really do. Is anybody here on the basketball team? Because I know basketball teams usually swear on their Nikes, don't they? And I was talking to, do you know Michael Franti? Have you ever heard of the group Spearhead? Yeah. Okay, I was talking to Michael Franti the other day, who is the person who started the group and the lead singer, lead rapper. He said that, he plays ball. And he decided that he was going to try to organize the people he plays basketball with, to stop buying Nikes. I think we need a global boycott. Not that the other companies treat their workers any better. They probably don't. But if we can't find a way to point out concretely, what is happening, then, we'll all continue to wear exploitation on our bodies without even being conscious of it. I mean, in a sense, we can't avoid wearing it because the clothes we wear are generally produced. There's a global assembly line, right? But at least we can be conscious of it. At least we can, in some way, participate in efforts to reveal what is going on and hopefully transform it. Now, getting back to the connection between the prison industrial complex and the assault on immigrants, you know, what happens is that many of the corporations that have been attracted to third world countries literally leave people without jobs here in this country because it's more profitable to pay wages of $2.50 an hour. A day. Sorry. I mean, that even $2.50 an hour is nothing. I mean, you get paid more than that at McDonald's. But when you consider, when you consider that, you know, companies, industrial, automobile companies, for example, they have left. Detroit used to be Motown, right? No longer. So what's happened to all of those people who historically have worked with those corporations that have decided that it is more profitable to move into a third world country and set up shop there? You know, these are the people precisely who end up participating in the alternative economies, in the drug economy, and taking drugs too. Or rather taking illicit drugs. You know, because a lot of people take drugs in this country. A lot of people take drugs. As a matter of fact, it's so interesting that there is this so-called war on drugs on the one hand, on certain kinds of drugs, and then other kinds of drugs are represented as the panacea, you know? You know, if you're caught with a little crack, you spend 5 years in prison. But then on the other hand, the pharmaceutical company tells you that Prozac is the way to make yourself feel better and to be more normal. As a matter of fact, if you look at the extent to which the war on illicit drugs has historically been tied to the development of psychotropic drugs in terms of the pharmaceutical corporations, there's another connection that we would have to make. You know, those who take Prozac don't go to prison, though. You know, they go to their corporate suites. They go to the university. Well, anyway, let me leave that. Because the point I also wanted to make, getting back to Indonesia, getting back to the corporations that have gone to Mexico and all over the third world, oftentimes these corporations wreak havoc on the local economies. People can no longer live once the corporations go in and set up shop. And so they begin to look towards the U.S. as a place to seek a better life, their lives having literally been destroyed by these immigrant corporations, you see. And what happens often is that they use precisely the same routes that have been carved out by the migrating corporations to come to this country. And all they want is a chance at a decent life. And here in this country, they are demonized. They are held responsible for unemployment. Nobody, you know, asked Nike, well, why don't you come back here and set up some factories in various you know, cities and states in the U.S. and provide jobs for the people to whom you are selling those shoes, many of whom go out and try to steal money in order to buy a $120 pair of Nikes. So you see what I mean about the connections that we fail to make when we succumb to the ideological effort to convince us that the real enemies are immigrants, the real immigrants are welfare mothers, the real immigrant, the real enemies are prisoners. And then, of course, there are prisons that are devoted to incarcerate so-called illegal immigrants, people without documents. Now, I spoke about a prison industrial complex, and I haven't really explained what I mean about that. Now, what often also happens is that prisons move in to the vacuum that has been left by these transnational corporations that go to the third world. And they are the institutions that provide jobs to people. Many people, you know, as a matter of fact, I heard that here in Colorado, at the Florence, the Federal Correctional Institution in Florence, that community people held a bake sale and got together and raised money. Is that right? To convince the federal government to build a prison there. I guess because they wanted the jobs. And if you look at the construction industry, one of the most developed sectors of the construction industry is prison construction. That's where the profits are now. Look at the role that architects play in creating these new institutions. Look at the extent to which prisons have been privatized, and the extent to which private corporations move in to take advantage of prison labor, because it is as cheap oftentimes, or almost as cheap, as third world labor. So there's a sense in which prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy, which means that there are stakes other than the anti-crime stakes that will keep the prison industry expanding. So it's acquiring its own momentum, which, if we don't attempt to intervene and stop it now, we will be, into the next millennium, we will be an increasingly incarcerated society. And that really scares me, because as I said before, I have been there. I know what it is like to live under those conditions. And I can't even pretend to have experienced what people who are sentenced to these super max control units are experiencing. I mean, I was in solitary confinement for about 15 months. And that was hard. It was really hard. I think the only reason I survived was because I had been a student. And I was used to spending time alone studying. Seriously. I mean, I really think that is the only reason why I did not go absolutely out of my mind. And I also learned how to practice yoga. So between yoga and reading and writing, I managed to safeguard my sanity. But what about people who don't have those skills, or who haven't been introduced to reading? Okay. Now I guess I'm supposed to wind up and say some words about what we can do. Because I don't want to depress you or frighten you. Or maybe I do. But only if you can move out of that depression or that fear and recognize that there are ways to make a difference here. One of the reasons why the prison industrial complex has expanded as it has is because we have learned how to forget about prisons, even if they are in our own neighborhoods, even if we have relatives and friends in prison. And if you look in communities of color, almost everybody knows someone who is there or has been there. But we don't know how to talk about it. We don't integrate ideas about what is going on in these places in our daily conversation. We don't teach about the prison system. It's almost as if what this society does, first of all, is gets rid of the people who have the problems, people who have drug problems, you know, rather than recognizing that they are hurting themselves and they need some help. They need someone to help them. Rather than recognizing that, they just send them to prison. And the majority of women who are in prison are in there in relation to drug-related charges, right? And non-violent drug-related charges. So the idea is just send them to prison, throw them away, get rid of them. And if you get rid of them, then we don't have to think about them. And if we don't have to think about them, then we don't have to think about the problems that they have. So we don't really have to address the issue of drugs, which would require us also to talk about pharmaceutical companies. So I guess what I want to suggest that we all do is figure out ways of making these issues visible. And for people who have relatives or friends in prison, don't be ashamed of it. Because of the way the criminal is constructed, represented, many of us are even afraid to admit that we know someone who could be that kind of a person. But prisoners are like you and me. I mean, yeah, there's some pretty bad people in prison, but there's some pretty bad people who are not in prison. You know? And a study I read indicated that probably 95% of the population in this country at one point in or another in their lives commits a crime. I mean, it may be like, you know, taking a candy bar and not paying for it. And I'm not going to ask everybody to raise their hands who hasn't committed a crime. You know, but think about it. Think about your lives. And think about who are the people who are then called to answer for that. And the role that the prison system then plays in manufacturing criminals and manufacturing crime. You know, one of the things I often point out with respect to my own experience was that, you know, when I went into jail, I was an assistant professor on my first job. I taught for 1 year, you know, longtime graduate student. And I really hadn't acquired very many skills with respect to, shoplifting and, you know, boosting or... But when I got into jail and the little time that I did spend with in the main population, which was in New York, I said it was about 4 weeks, you know, one of the things that happened was that every day the women practice. They practice. There was one woman who, sort of a big woman, who boasted that she could walk out of a store with a color television set between her legs. TV sets were much smaller then. We didn't have the big screen one, so. But she would teach the women how to, you know, walk naturally with objects, books and things like that, between their legs. And there was like nothing else to do. There was no recreation, you know, and it was fun. You know, so I also learned, you know, I acquired some new skills. If I had gotten out and decided that I wanted to become a booster, I would have known how to do it. And I'm just talking about this on a very small scale, you know. In a larger sense, the prisons produce crime and criminals. Some of you may have read Michel Foucault, Discipline and Punish. There's a sense in which that argument that he makes is really true, concretely. So what do we do? How do we You know, how do we create contact between the inside and the outside? Between prison and what prisoners call the free world. Prisoners see us as living in the free world. I don't know how free this world is, because it certainly isn't free for a lot of people who are out here. But at least we can take advantage of the fact that we have the ability to move around in ways that people who are inside don't. As a matter of fact, we can sort of think about the relationship as being the relationship between slaves and abolitionists. Now, because as a matter of fact, the prison system contains obvious vestiges of slavery. Right? The 13th Amendment abolished slavery for all except those who are being punished for committing a crime. So in a lot of ways, what we see in the penitentiary system in this country is the continuation of the system of slavery. And that is why many of us suggest that what we need during this period is a late 20th century abolitionist movement, as there was a 19th century abolitionist movement. You know, which doesn't mean that, you know, often I say abolitionist movement, abolish the prisons, and what are you going to do with all of those people who are inside? Well, you know, the question is not simply to tear down all of the walls, and I think most of them should be torn down. But the question is creating some new institutions that really will speak to the problems that people have who go to prison, you know, rather than this prison system which continues to reproduce the problems, you know, for which people are sent to prison. One set of institutions consists of educational institutions. It costs much more to send someone to prison than it does to college or university. And many of those people who are now in prison would do well in an institution like this, would do better than a lot of the existing students. But of course, you know, that's a kind of that the abolitionist strategy is one that is a protracted strategy down the line. What can we do now? I want to suggest that those of you who are students here and faculty, you know, think about, you know, ways of creating lines of communication between prisoners and students. As a matter of fact, that is the kind of coalitional formation that I think has an enormous amount of potential during this period. Prisoners are generally considered as people who have no agency. And if we talk about doing work around prisons, it's often with a missionary kind of posture, that we want to save these poor souls. We don't think about prisoners as human beings who have a right to participate in the efforts that perhaps will lead to change. So I want to suggest the possibility of classes. I used to teach a class on incarcerated women at San Francisco State University. And I took a number of the students from San Francisco State into the San Francisco County Jail because I taught a class at the San Francisco County Jail as well. And one would think that, okay, you know, perhaps the students should teach the prisoners, but I decided to reverse it. I decided that the first phase would be for the students to learn from the prisoners. So the prisoners were positioned as the teachers, and they taught the students about that institution, what went on there, what the problems were. And then they got to choose how they felt the students could be effective, what skills the students had that they might use. And that worked out, you know, very well. I want to suggest that, you know, those kinds of connections can be, you know, easily established if people simply take the initiative to do them. Artists can go can attempt to, you know, go into jails and prisons and teach classes, performing artists, visual artists. You know, some of you might want to go in and teach a general education course. What we need to do, since they won't let the majority of the people who are in out, we need to go knocking on the doors. No, we need to go knocking on the doors. We have to argue for a relationship, for communications between the free world and the unfree world. And finally, I want to suggest that we think about the larger picture, the assault against affirmative action, the increasing conservatism. You know, I don't think I'm going to forget the way those buildings that focus on the family complex look for a long time. I mean, that is amazing. That is amazing. And it's not that we don't want to focus on our families. But the family is used in this ideological way. I mean, who is the real family, right? The real family is generally nuclear. The father works. The mother's supposed to stay at home and be a good wife and mother. So the single mother is not, and her children, they don't count as a family. There's a great deal of homophobia that is implied by that particular construction of the family, so that gays and lesbians who have families don't have, quote, real families, according to these people over there on the hill. You know, I truly believe that those who are really committed to the kind of conservative politics that is messing up our lives today are the minority of people in this country. Oh, that was a slip. I hope that, I mean, they look like the majority. But that's because the rest of us are relatively silent. And I want to urge every single one of you who have come out to participate in this community building moment to think very deeply about what you can do to make a difference. Thank you very much.
The height of what some people call the prison movement, some of us try to call the anti-prison movement, was achieved in the aftermath of George Jackson's assassination. And we know that within a few weeks, there was an enormous uprising at Attica, which managed to place these issues on the agenda of the country in a way that had never happened before. The Attica Rebellion also helped to bring people who had never considered associating themselves with prisoners into the campaign.